From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As of this week, thanks to an anonymous blogger and ABC News, we know all about the creepy electronic messages Congressman Mark Foley of Florida sent to his pages. We also learned that two Florida papers, the Miami Herald and the St. Petersburg Times, may have been sitting on the story for almost a year. Here's how it went for the St. Petersburg Times.
In November, the paper obtained a couple of Foley email exchanges that had been forwarded by a page to a friend in another congressional office. The Times knew that the page had given Foley his email address voluntarily and had told his friend in the other office that he'd had no suspicions about Foley. But when Foley asked for a picture, then the page acknowledged that he was uncomfortable. The Times said it saw nothing explicitly sexual and that it was all a little ambiguous.
So, with no one on the record, they sat on it. It might seem that the paper couldn't win for losing. If their story turned out to be more smoke than fire, it would have been slammed for overkill. St. Petersburg Times executive editor Neil Brown.
The fallout didn't particularly figure into our thinking. The fallout of printing a thin story. We just don't like to print thin stories. We thought it didn't meet our standard back in November based on what we had.
In a where there's smoke, there must be fire situation. One argument for running story number one is that it'll generate more information, which is exactly what happened in this case. ABC posted something very brief and relatively innocuous on its website. And, you know, and next thing you know, well, you know the next thing. It all blew up. So how much do you torment yourself about what might have been had you run, you know, even a thin story about a congressman's unusual behavior?
I wouldn't say we're tormented by it, but you've just described the balancing act we face on something like this. I certainly get the point and understand that good beat reporting sometimes requires a shorter, maybe even less complete story to see if you can shake the bushes. The problem you have is that the innuendo was potentially so damaging and explosive that you've got to weigh your standards on whether you can imply something in hopes that it'll shake something that's even more advanced as far as the story goes.
The other possibility is that the St. Pete Times was too responsible by half, you know, that you somehow allowed yourself to forget that a grown-up asking a teenager for his photo is just unlikely to have an innocent explanation.
I think that's a fair criticism that we're trying to work through. It certainly seems, based on what we know now, that maybe that analysis was too cautious, but we have this benefit of hindsight.
As events have unfolded, do you think you made the right decision?
I don't know. I will say we deliberated quite long, and we thought this always was a close call. I know this. We didn't like being scooped. We absolutely wished we'd broken a story sooner. Could we have broken a story sooner based on what we had? I'd like to think that our standards mean something, and just because I know some outcome I didn't know before, I wouldn't suddenly say, we should have done it. We were really sincere and earnest in trying to be responsible. Was it too cautious? I don't know. I think the question we're asking ourselves more directly isn't, was that story worthy of publication? It's, should we have had a fuller discussion about some next steps? So if not on that day when we didn't run the story back in November, but sometime between then and when it exploded in the last several days, we could have gotten something into the paper. That's what I really regret, that we didn't find a way to do that.
Okay, Neil, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Neil Brown is executive editor of the St. Petersburg Times. Brian Ross is chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. He had a tip about Foley's emails, too. After a few weeks, he called a page and never heard back. So he went to Foley's office. They said that the emails were authentic, but that Foley was just a friendly guy. That seems strange enough to Ross that he did a brief item on the blotter, ABC News' website. Within hours, they received tips from congressional pages offering more, even creepier, Foley emails. ABC called Foley's office again, read aloud from one of the new emails, and an hour later, the network got a call saying that Foley was resigning. So I asked Brian Ross, did he think the Florida papers blew it?
Well, stories beget stories. They do. You know, small burglaries can be big scandals in the end, and questionable emails can also, I think, as we see here, lead to big scandals. Those papers, I respect the people who work at both of the Florida newspapers, made different news judgments, and probably because Foley is a Florida congressman, they felt they couldn't just do a small story on a Florida congressman. They have to do a full out. From our point of view, he was one of, you know, 435 congressmen across the country, and we felt we could do a small item in which there was concern about the emails, a denial from the congressman, and that's what we did.
Now, you approached Foley's office, and you said, look, we have these emails. Let me have an explanation. And you had a very interesting conversation with one of his staffers. Tell me about that, please.
I did. The call came back. He's going to resign, and we want to make a deal with you. So I got on the phone, and the person who was offering the deal was Foley's former chief of staff, who at the time was working for another Republican congressman. His name is Kirk Fordham. And he said, I'll give you the exclusive on the resignation. It can be all yours alone. All you have to do is just not publish any of those really vile instant messages that the congressman wrote. It'd be very bad for his family and so on and so forth. And I said, we're not going to anyway, out of good taste, publish the worst of it, and we haven't. But I'm not going to make a deal where I have my hands tied in any way editorially by some commitment.
Clearly, the young people who are at the heart of this story were not thrilled that it was coming out. Few went on the record, and most, I gather, consider this a chapter that they'd more or less like to forget. But since the story has broken, have you heard from any of these kids or their parents to say, well, you know, upon further consideration, thank you for letting this get out. It's made a difference in our lives.
I've heard both, to be honest with you. We've received lots of messages. Thanks from hundreds of pages. My gosh, somebody finally stood up to them. We thank you. And then some of the pages who are more specifically involved are upset, as you say, is the chapter of their lives they are not proud of. But I think they have to understand that they were victims of a very manipulative person. And you look at those messages back and forth, and that's what it was. He was manipulating these kids who looked up to him, and that's a real scandal, I think, is when there's an abuse of power, and that's what I see in this case.
Okay, Brian, always nice to talk to you.
Great, Bob, thanks.
Brian Ross is chief investigative correspondent for ABC News.
When you have a PR crisis, you need a crisis manager. Richard Levick is CEO of a crisis management firm that has been called in on such PR nightmares as the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal and most recently, Spinach. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You're the president of a crisis management PR firm. If Mark Foley had called you a week ago, what advice would you have for him?
I'm not so sure we'd take the call. You know, the first thing you want to do when you sense a crisis is you want to run to it. And what you have here is someone who was aware of this situation for many years, a party who was aware of it for at least a year. You have to deal with the situation early. If you don't address it head on, what it does is it starts to rot all the way to the top.
What do you think of the strategy that was taken by Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert and later Newt Gingrich followed his lead, saying, well, they knew about it, but since it was a gay thing, they didn't want to blow the whistle on him because they'd be accused of gay bashing. And it's really the political correctness police that kept the situation going for so long.
You know, I know this is radio and we're not allowed to have dead silences on air, but that's exactly how those concepts were greeted. They just didn't work. So what we saw already this week was there's a state representative in West Virginia and already photos, inappropriate photos of him naked with two other men in body paint. And of course, he's a Democrat. So
what do you expect?
I'm not going to answer that question. But what you can expect from a media point of view is that if you're the Republicans now, a smart strategy is to try and put a plague on both your houses, make the Democrats look just as bad as the Republicans. The problem from a media point of view is that they have run as the party of family values. What you want to do in all stories, there are three roles: villain, victim, and vindicator. What you have going on at the Republican congressional level is trying to distract the story. And what Mark Foley is trying to do is he's trying to move himself from being the villain over to being a victim. And that's why he's come out and said, you know, one day it's an alcoholic, one day, well, it's the fact that I'm gay, and one day that it's the church that made me do it.
We saw Representative Bob Ney of Ohio, who is implicated in the Jack Abramoff scandal, check into rehab for alcoholism. This is a confessional culture.
Confessions may be good for the soul, but they're only sometimes good for the media. The proper strategy for Mark Foley would have been to apologize profusely to the victims, to the families, to the United States Congress, to America, and then to have exited stage right.
What about language? You mentioned the word inappropriate. That's a word that the Republicans have really liked to use. Tony Snow, White House spokesman, said that, quote, there have been other scandals, as you know, that have been more than simply naughty emails. That's what he wanted to call it. If you succeed in getting the press to use the words you want, can you change how this story goes down?
Without question. I mean, I think that it's always a battle of the words to change subjects dramatically. As important as words are, though, pictures are even more important. We're not readers as a society. We're scanners. What we do is we look at pictures. We don't think, we feel. And people already see the picture here, and they ultimately hear the words, but they are feeling about the act.
And the picture that they're seeing is of those emails, are you horny, etc.
And that is why on all the television programs regarding Mark Foley, they actually write out the email so you can see them on the screen.
A lot of the coverage, though, seemed to move very quickly from Foley himself to a Republican cover-up and the potential impact on the election. Is it usual for the point of the story to change so quickly?
You know, the gods of Washington demand a sacrifice. And Foley could have been sacrificed early on in the process. But because the Republican Congress did not get in front of the story, what you're finding is that there are more calls for a sacrifice. You know, every day we receive 3,000 to 5,000 messages. We're overwhelmed with information. Try to remember just three messages from yesterday. It's incredibly difficult to do. What Mark Foley has succeeded in doing is becoming front and center a story just a month prior to election. And in order for people to get onto the next story, we need to feel that it was addressed. And just as I mentioned earlier, villain, victim, and vindicator. We already know that he's the villain, but he's already out to pasture. He's not valuable enough as a sacrifice anymore. And that's why Speaker Hastert is at the center of the cross. Hairs.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Richard Levick is author of Stop the Presses, the Litigation PR Desk Reference.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Monday morning, as the cable news channels were still digesting stories from the weekend past, news broke of a school shooting in Pennsylvania's Amish country. Details were sketchy, and so the anchors reverted to what they could hardly avoid, namely that there seemed to be something of a trend afoot.
Another tragic shooting at a school in the United States. Last week, of course, we talked about what happened in Colorado and Wisconsin. Today, it is Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Unbelievable to see this once again when last week, we were dealing with a deadly shooting in Colorado, a deadly shooting in Wisconsin, and now
it's early, so we need to say, have a copycat shooting.
Indeed, only 3 days before Charles Roberts IV walked into that schoolhouse, a high school student in Wisconsin had fatally shot the school principal. And 2 days before that, a man in his 50s had walked into a school in Bailey, Colorado, sexually assaulted a group of girls while holding them hostage, and murdered one of them before killing himself. On September 13th, a man allegedly obsessed with Columbine had opened fire in a Montreal college, killing a student and then himself. And in late August, another Columbine-like shooting had taken place in Hillsboro, North Carolina, just a few days after a teacher was shot to death in her Vermont school. But while the media pointed to the possibility of a copycat effect, they didn't spend much time examining their own complicity in it. And that troubles Lauren Coleman, a suicide prevention consultant and school violence researcher up in Maine. He says school shootings have occurred in clusters for a decade, and wall-to-wall coverage hasn't helped.
It really began in 1996, in which kids from the schools that they then would go back into and do the shootings often were wearing these long black coats, were coming in with guns, modeling it very specifically after things they were seeing in fiction or on the news. Columbine, unfortunately, got so much publicity that it now is the seminal model, the black cloud over many of these shootings. The one that happened, for instance, in Hillsboro, North Carolina, on August 29th, that individual who shot up the school, they asked why, and he said, Columbine, remember Columbine? And they discovered that he'd killed his father at home before he'd come to school.
Now, you said that Columbine, unfortunately, got a lot of media attention. What do you mean by that?
I think that one of the reasons that I wrote my book, The Copycat Effect, was really to try to begin the debate within the media about how much is too much. The graphic details that we see on the cable wall-to-wall coverage and in some other media really sets up a situation where these vulnerable people have a model in front of them to then plan their outrages in the similar fashion. Since August 24th, these individuals have all been males. They've all been Caucasian. They all have been outsiders, either expelled students or older males. And they all have victimized females, young girls usually, or authority figures in the case of principals or teachers or guards.
Clearly, we see individuals copying at least aspects from previous episodes. But apart from a hunch or, you know, a series of anecdotal information that seems to coincide, is there any real science to demonstrate that there is, in fact, a copycat effect?
Yes, indeed, and it's called the Werner effect. There's 30 years of research, and mostly from Dr. David Phillips in California, a sociologist, and myself and other individuals who studied newspaper reports of suicides. For instance, the research done on the suicide of Marilyn Monroe showed that there was 197 copycat suicides over and above the national average during the month after her suicide. And you can see this with Freddie Prinze. You can see it with Kurt Cobain. And so the celebrity suicides get a lot of attention. But there's also been serious research done on suicides that appear in the newspapers and how they increase with more coverage, front page coverage versus back of the paper coverage. It's well known in the suicidology field. It's well known in the sociology field. I just feel it's time for it to be brought forward and discussed because the media has ignored it for so long.
I can see how moderating coverage of suicides may have an effect on suicide clusters and may be the right way for the media to behave. But when you're talking about someone going into a community, taking many victims, terrorizing an entire community, you can't possibly be suggesting that that doesn't in itself constitute news that must be reported.
Do we need to know what Charles Roberts had in his little bag? Do we need to know that he had KY jelly? Do we need to know that he had restraints and bolts on a board in which he was going to terrorize these young girls? It's one thing to talk about the bare facts. There was a school shooting. So-and-so was killed. to really talk more about the victims than we actually talk about the shooter would be a first good step. There were many things that happened with regard to the Amish situation that concerns me about how much information was given the week before in Colorado. If you look at how Bailey was handled, helicopters overhead, specific details about the sexual abuse, even down to the specific tactical details about how law enforcement went into school, repeating over and over again, doesn't this look like Columbine? I think that there's a thin line here between reporting and actually setting up a model of behavior for the next individual.
Let's just say that the copycat effect is behind this extraordinary and horrifying cluster of killings. And let's just assume for a moment that the media have the responsibility in general to report these disruptions in the society. What should we do or specifically not do the next time around?
Well, I think that first of all, there needs to be a debate. I don't think it should be any governmental regulations. I think that the media really need to start talking amongst themselves. There's a situation that I'm a big baseball fan, and there's a situation that happens during live baseball games. If someone runs out on a baseball field, the camera turns away and the commentators say, well, we don't want to show that because we'll encourage it. I think it's the same thing.
Lauren Coleman, thank you very much.
It's great being here.
Lauren Coleman is the author of The Copycat Effect, How the Media and Popular Culture Trigger the Mayhem in Tomorrow's Headlines.
This week, the Miami Herald Publishing Company was caught in an intramural dust-up. After just 14 months on the job, publisher Jesus Diaz resigned. He wrote in a letter to readers that he mismanaged the firing last month of three reporters at El Nuevo Herald, the company's Spanish-language daily. The reporters were making paid appearances on radio and TV Martí, U.S. government-funded anti-Castro propaganda outlets. But Diaz said it hadn't been made clear to the reporters that they couldn't work, both for the newspaper and the government. So Diaz asked the reporters to return and then resigned himself. We asked Dan Gretsch, a former Miami Herald employee now working for Marketplace, to explain what went wrong this week in Miami.
Publisher Jesus Diaz oversaw two newspapers, the Miami Herald, of course, and El Nuevo Herald, the highest circulation Spanish-language newspaper in the United States. Diaz was forced to resign this week in large part because he had lost the confidence of both newsrooms. That erosion began last summer, just 9 days into Diaz's tenure as publisher. On July 27, 2005, Miami Herald columnist Jim DeFitte interviewed a distraught Miami City commissioner. DeFitte made a rash decision to tape the conversation without telling the commissioner, which is illegal in Florida. Minutes later, the commissioner shot himself in the head in the Miami Herald lobby. DeFitte took the tapes to his bosses at the Herald and asked what he should do. Jesus Diaz fired him on the spot.
The night that I was fired, Jesus Diaz walked out into the newsroom. This was told to me by several people. And they said, why did the decision have to be made so quickly? Why did it have to be made right now? And Jesus Diaz's exact words, and several people wrote them down, was, we needed to distance ourselves from him as quickly as possible.
Last month, it was El Nuevo Herald's turn. Diaz quickly fired three El Nuevo journalists who worked on the side for Radio Martí. It later emerged that a total of 8 staffers and 29 freelancers made paid appearances on Radio or TV Martí since 2001. Diaz admitted in a note to readers that the paper's conflict of interest policy was, quote, ambiguously communicated, inconsistently applied, and widely misunderstood. He invited the three fired journalists back. The final straw came when he tried to kill a September 17th column by Carl Hyacin about the El Nuevo firings. Hyacin was interviewed Tuesday by NPR News.
I was told that my column was going to be fuel on the fire, and my response was, who cares? Since when do I worry about what the circulation numbers are? When they told me my column wasn't going to run, my response was that you'll have my resignation in the morning.
The Miami Herald's new owner, the McClatchy Company, was forced to step in. They sided with the columnist. As for Jesus Diaz, the writing was on the wall. Former columnist Jim DeFitte.
The role of a publisher should be to back your reporters, to be supportive of the people you're in the trenches with. And Jesus Diaz's mentality was always to throw those people under the bus.
I couldn't reach Diaz for comment, but a bigger, more complicated media story emerged in the days following his resignation, the conflict in values between the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. The two newspapers may share the same building and the same publisher, but they have fundamentally different approaches to journalism. The Miami Herald, like most U.S. newspapers, prizes objectivity. El Nuevo Herald is more like papers in Latin America and Europe that push for social change. El Nuevo has many staffers who fled Fidel Castro's Cuba. Several had been political prisoners. Those reporters who went on Radio Martí were passionate advocates for regime change long before they freelanced for the U.S. government program. Miami sociologist Dario Moreno says the fired El Nuevo reporters felt they were suddenly being held to a different standard, the standard of the Miami Herald.
If your paper is taking the Latin American tradition of an ideological newspaper, and people at El Nuevo knew it, what was the violation of journalistic ethics?
For evidence of this different standard, consider a photo El Nuevo published in June. It appeared to show Cuban police ignoring prostitutes as the prostitutes solicited a tourist. But it was a fake, a crude mashup of two separate images. This is the sort of thing that gets journalists fired at other papers. But in a note to readers, El Nuevo called it un fotomontaje artístico, an artistic photomontage, and no one was punished. Humberto Castillo is the editor of El Nuevo Herald. He says he's trying to move his reporters away from the advocacy journalism that once defined the paper. He says he didn't know some of his staffers were also getting paid by Radio and TV Martí.
I never give them permission, and I've never was told about the situation.
Several staffers say they had permission to work for Martí from Castillo's predecessor, Carlos Castañeda, who died in 2002. Castillo says his paper publishes negative stories about Fidel Castro because that reflects the reality in Cuba.
We have nothing good to say about him, no? or the way that the Cubans live. But that is not advocacy. You know, that's a position that reflects what is happening in this part of the world.
For years, the newsrooms of the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald have clashed. When I was at the Herald, we sometimes kept sensitive stories out of early editions of the paper so El Nuevo reporters wouldn't leak them to the local Cuban community. This clash was evident on September 8th when a page one story by the Miami Herald outed the El Nuevo reporters as working for Radio Martí. Mugshots of the suspect reporters accompanied the piece. Sociologist Dario Moreno.
This relationship has been a culture clash over the last 26 years. And I think this is just the latest incident.
That culture clash was on clear display the afternoon of Diaz's resignation. The company called a meeting in the cafeteria for both newsrooms. The Herald's executive editor, Tom Fiedler, said under no circumstances can his reporters appear on Radio or TV Martí. El Nuevo's Castillo said his reporters can appear, just not for money. So what's the Herald's policy? I posed that question to the man who replaced Diaz as the Herald's publisher, David Landsberg.
Quite frankly, we haven't come to a total conclusion yet. I think we need to spend the next couple weeks really thoughtfully thinking about the question and deciding which cases could be a conflict and which ones would not.
Can two newsrooms with different ethical standards continue to live under one roof? Landsberg says no.
So we may be producing different products for different markets, but we want to come to the table with the same ethics and principles. We generally don't want to be advocating things in the newspaper. We want to be reporting on them.
Landsberg has inherited an almost intractable situation. Top on his to-do list?
I'm about 60% or 70% capable in Spanish, so yo entiendo mucho.
Become fluent in Spanish. For On the Media, I'm Dan Gretsch.
On Friday, Fox News Channel turned 10. In the interest of full disclosure, there's not much love lost between us. They'll never supply us with anyone to interview. And Garfield once refused to go on Bill O'Reilly's show, so he took umbrage at us on his air for things we said about him on our air.
Basically, this is a far-left bomb thrower, Garfield,
right,
who, if you are perceived to be by him a conservative or traditionalist, he's going to come after you no matter what.
Though its audience has begun to erode, in its first decade, Fox News Channel revolutionized 24-hour cable news and maybe even tinkered with the meaning of news itself. CNN and MSNBC have struggled against that juggernaut by filling the time with fewer reports and more hot air, as conservative commentator Cal Thomas noted on Fox News Watch.
All of them are trying to copy Fox now, to be honest. Many of them are doing more tabloid, more big lip blondes and all this kind of stuff. There's only so much of that trailer trash pie to go around. And you gotta get out there and do the serious stuff once in a while.
Yeah, he was kidding, sort of. But Fox News Channel does provide a safe harbor for those who feel slighted by most of the rest of the media. Vice President Dick Cheney has stipulated that TVs in his hotel rooms be pre-tuned to Fox. He wants fair and balanced news from reporters like senior business correspondent Brenda Butner, who muses here on the potential impact of a terrorist attack on the stock market.
Thank God, and thank President Bush, it hasn't happened here yet. But they've been trying, and President Bush has been trying to stop them, despite the opposition of some very misled people.
Fox News has loyal viewers. Research says they're not the best informed viewers, more likely to believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11 and that he had weapons of mass destruction. But then Fox News' on-air talent seems to believe those things. Still. Although after Fox News Channel interviewer Chris Wallace had his famous dust-up with former President Clinton, he was defended by liberal commentator Neil Gabler.
He is not a Hannity. He is not an O'Reilly. He is not a Brehume. He is not a Cavuto. He is not a John Gibson.
Could you Could you put one person on that list from another network?
Well, I'm talking about this
place.
Network. He is not a shill for the Bush administration.
Now, that remark also was made on Fox News Watch, which airs on Sunday mornings, hosted by Eric Burns. So Fox News Channel may not be fair and balanced in prime time, but its weekend media show is at least free and easy. And the cable channel's broadcast counterpart, the Fox Network, is downright brutal.
In Springfield today, a sex scandal has brought in reporters from around the world. Why, here's Fox News.
So happy birthday, Fox News Channel, from your friends, the far left-wing bomb throwers. Thanks for all the material.
Up next, journalists who put their big ideas on the big screen.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Watching the attacks on September 11th, 2001, novelist, screenwriter, and New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright observed with horror that it looked like a movie. Then he had a further thought. It looks like my movie. In his 1998 film, The Siege, starring Denzel Washington, Bruce Willis, and Annette Bening, Muslim extremists carry out a series of terrorist attacks in New York City. In a desperate attempt to impose order, the U.S. government secretly detains and tortures suspects and suspends scores of civil liberties.
What if what they really want is for us to herd children in the stadiums like we're doing? And put soldiers on the street and have Americans looking over their shoulders, bend the law, shred the Constitution just a little bit. Because if we torture him, General, we do that and everything that we have bled and fought and died for is over. And they've won. They've already won.
Whether they've won is an idea that has been bandied about ever since 2001, but who thought of it in 1998? 8 years later and 5 years after September 11th, Lawrence Wright published The Looming Tower. Built around 600 interviews with those closest to al-Qaeda, it documents al-Qaeda's real-life success at creating a world not unlike the one he depicted. One could say even predicted in The Siege. He joins us now. Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke. It's good to be with you.
So here's a question that you probably haven't gotten for 8 years, but where did the idea for The Siege come from?
Well, Linda Oakes, who was the producer, had been talking to me about doing a movie about a woman in the CIA. That was her idea. And the problem was that the Cold War was over, and how are you going to do a CIA story? And then I realized that the CIA does have a real-life antagonist, and it's the FBI. And what were they fighting over? They were fighting over who was going to control counterterrorism in the U.S. And so that was where the original germ of the idea arose.
Hey, we're on the same team here, Agent Hubbard.
Who exactly is we on this particular team? I tell you what, Elise. You send me an official interagency request for cooperation, then I'll give you copies of everything we come up with. How's that? CIA has no charter to operate domestically, which puts you in violation of federal law.
Now, as a much younger man, you had lived for a while in Cairo. What about your experience fed into this?
I was a conscientious objector during Vietnam, and I had to get a job for 2 years of alternative service, and I wanted to get out of the country. And so I went to the UN, and I made application. They said, well, no, we don't do that, but here's a list of American institutions abroad, and one of them had an office directly across the street. It was the American University in Cairo. I didn't realize that we had no diplomatic relations at all, and there were only 200 Americans in the entire country at that time, and they were trying to keep a university afloat. So it turned out to be an amazingly fateful walk across the street for me. I loved Egypt, had a wonderful time. But I drew upon those experiences when I wrote The Siege, and then when 9/11 happened, the fact that I had lived in an Arab world and spoke some Arabic and was familiar and actually fond of that culture, you know, really came into play.
What was your experience when you watched the towers fall on TV?
Well, you know, it took a little while for it to sink in because I had the same experience everybody did of, you know, how cinematic this whole event is. And then the kind of sickening private realization that, you know, that a lot of this was stuff we had in The Siege, you know, in the army and the troops in the streets of New York and things like that were scenes that were, you know, gallingly familiar to me.
But the question is how you could have been so prophetic.
I'm sure everyone here knows the traditional model of the terrorist network. One cell controls all others. Cut off the head, the body will wither. Unfortunately, the old wisdom no longer applies. The new paradigm is each cell operates independent of the other. Cut off one head, another rises up in its place.
All of this was predictable. I'm not a prophet. I interviewed members of the counterterrorist squad in New York and the FBI, and I guess the movie reflected their anxiety about what would happen. I looked at what had happened in other incidents, like in Panama, when we invaded Panama and we rounded people up and put them in stadiums. So you see that scene in The Siege. And the question of torture, civil liberties. The whole premise of the movie is what would happen if terrorism came to our shores? You know, what kind of country would we become? So it was a what-if type of movie, and unfortunately, things played out pretty much according to plan. As a reporter, whether I'm, you know, writing a movie or an article or a book, I just try to get close to people who know and spend as much time as I can with them.
But are you a reporter when you're interviewing people in preparation for a movie?
Oh, yeah. I guess I'm reality-based, and I feel more comfortable when I feel like what I'm writing is actually what would happen. It's true that people oftentimes are dazzled by Hollywood, and it makes it easier when they think it's going to be fiction in one way or another than when they think, oh my God, every word that's going to come out of my mouth is going to be in print. I might get in trouble with my boss and so on. You know, people always have those concerns. But, you know, when you enter the world of fiction, and especially the world of Hollywood, the only difference is that you often get people who want you to pay them for, you know, their time.
The Looming Tower is exhaustively researched, and it's been much praised for that, but it's also celebrated for its narrative momentum. It's a real page-turner. What lessons did you apply from your work as a screenwriter or as a novelist to your reporting?
Faced with a huge amount of material and very complicated stuff, I realized that more than in any of my other writing, this book was going to need strong characters and great scenes. And if you have a great character, you can load him up like a donkey, you know, with all this information, and then you can enter into this scene, and then you can stop and you can take your time and you can explain. And that's the way movies are constructed, and I think it's true for most strong narrative writing.
And this weekend at the New Yorker Festival, you're performing a one-man show about your Al-Qaeda reporting. And you begin by juxtaposing TV images of real terrorist attacks with scenes from the siege.
Yeah, it's a new departure for me, although I love theater and I have written plays, but I've never written one for me to perform in. You know, it was provocative. It was really intriguing to me. And I thought that would be an interesting way of telling a story, just to be able to sit in front of an audience and relate these events in a more intimate and personal way.
What's next? Are you going to do it on skates?
I think I need to write a musical comedy, Brooke. Terrorism is not a beat that I want to be on all of my life, but there's no doubt that we're going to be living with these kinds of problems for a long time. So I guess that I'll always be attached to this problem. And yet there's a part of me that is, I really do have a movie musical comedy I'd love to write. I've been fantasizing, and some of those nights in Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, I would consider, I don't have to be here. A lot of these things, Brooke, they just come to you. You know, an idea is the most precious thing you ever get. And they come to you in these packages and they say, hey, look, I'm a novel or I'm a nonfiction book or whatever. And sometimes you discover that they might be more than one thing. But right now, I'm waiting for the next message. I haven't gotten it yet.
Lawrence Wright, thank you very much.
It was a great pleasure, Brooke. Thanks.
Lawrence Wright is the author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, and a staff writer for The New Yorker.
Forty-two years ago, director Michael Apted began a series of films that have become quietly historic. Using a Jesuit maxim, give me the child until he is seven and I will give you the man, Apted began following a group of British seven-year-olds, 14 of them originally.
I'm going to work in Woolworths. When I grow up, I want to be an astronaut.
When I get married, I'd like to have two children.
My heart's desire is to see my daddy.
I don't want to answer that.
The film was called Seven Up, and every 7 years since, Apted has made another film charting the children's progress. The Up series was originally intended for British television and was meant to explore the degree to which Britons were defined by class. Thought to be too British for any other audience, it has instead become the blueprint for what film can do and a kind of unlikely prototype for our own reality TV culture. Apted's newest iteration, just released, is called 49 Up, and he joins us now. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It seems to me that the central premise was something along the lines that class distinctions are immutable and they are destined to inform our lives into adulthood. four decades later, do you believe that class still determines everything?
Well, in many ways, it was designed as a self-fulfilling prophecy. It was my job to go out and find the children, and I was instructed really to find them from the margins of society, from the very empowered, not the reasonably empowered, and from the very impoverished. One of the caveats I have about talking about the film is when it's presented, is this a portrait of Great Britain? You know, I say, well, it's a portrait of a generation that was born in the mid-50s. That's now 50 years old. If had I started the film 5, 10, 15 years later, it would have been different, not substantially different, but nonetheless different. England still governed by, you know, the accident of birth, but to a lesser and lesser extent.
When these kids were 7, I got to tell you, Michael, there were a couple of them I hated. There was this one little girl who looked like she was going to turn into some future Margaret Thatcher nightmare who has actually turned out quite well.
I thought she was toffee-nosed, and she was extremely difficult when she was 14 and 21, and you can see it on the film. But then at 28, she clearly had an epiphany and got a grip of herself and grew up, whatever you want to call it, and got married, had children, and was a whole different character. In some cases, I think she's been, you know, very inspirational to people. But, you know, the people were chosen very haphazardly, and it is amazing how they've all turned out. I had no idea that they would become such rich characters. Now, is that telling me some great truth that everybody has a story, that everybody has poetry in their voices? I don't know. I like to think in some ways it does, that if you celebrate the ordinary life, which these films do, then people can really deliver stuff that can be illuminating.
One of the little boys you spoke to was a happy-go-lucky little kid named Neil with a big, bright smile on his face. Good-looking kid. Just seems to be loving life.
When I grow up, I want to be an astronaut. But if I can't be an astronaut, I think I'll be a coach driver.
He grows up to be a very troubled, sometimes desperate young man who is intermittently homeless and has all the appearances of being at least borderline schizophrenic. Tell me about Neil.
Well, I mean, his life, as you describe, is a roller coaster. I think that those of us, you know, who saw him at 28 up and 35 up, you really did wonder whether he was going to make it to the next film. But then at 42, we see him back in society and, in fact, a politician, which is, I suppose, ironic and whatever. And at 49 again, you know, he seems to have a much more positive view of the world, and you begin to get flashes of that 7-year-old twinkle and that vitality.
On tape, they have expressed some degree of misgivings about their participation.
It has to be said that I bitterly regret that the headmaster of the school where I was when I was 7 pushed me forward for this series, because every 7 years, a little pill of poison is injected into... Well, that's the truth.
I think there is a lot of residual resentment from them because, you know, they had no say in being part of it and suddenly find they're stuck with it. Some of them love it, some of them middling about it, and some resent that. For me, that's one of the toughest jobs I have, is to try and persuade them to do it every 7 years. And what happened in 49 Up, which is much more discussion about being in the films, is the guerrilla of reality television, which didn't exist in when we did 42 Up. And I think that's posed all sorts of questions to them about what is the nature of the Up films, and is it reality, is it documentary, are we being exploited, should we be making tons of money, is this something that we should be associated with or not? So I think those questions became asked, and I think it's very much, you know, in the public mind, the whole morality and value of reality television, and therefore I think it's in the minds of the people in my film.
Do you agree not to go in certain directions, not to cover certain parts of their lives, to just leave some of their stories out?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I'm a total prisoner to the system. If you do longitudinal work, then you have to behave yourself, because you certainly won't be asked back next time, or they won't come back next time. So, and also, some of them demand to see the product before I've locked it up. And again, I can hardly refuse. And, you know, we have discussions about it and we argue about it, and I win some and lose some battles. But I really don't see what choice I have if I want to keep them involved and with a continuing presence in it.
In the very beginning of the first episodes, Seven Up, 42 years ago. You quote the Jesuit maxim, give me the child until he is seven, and I will give you the man. Is that actually true?
A bit of it's true. I think what I get out of it is that there's a core personality that you see at seven that really doesn't go away. But I like to think that we are masters of our own fates to a lesser and greater degree. But nonetheless, it's certainly true that in any of the industrial societies, there's a deep unfairness at work, that some people get options and other people get a lot less options. But whether, of course, at the end of the day, they're any less or more happy than the others, is that's a question only the viewer can answer. And one of the great problems I've always had doing the film is not to project my own middle-class neurosis about what happiness is. Happiness to me is, you know, successful career, making money, my children and my marriage and all that. But, you know, other people have different value systems and I have to respect that. And if other people haven't bothered to search for a career and have been happy to do what I would consider routine jobs, that doesn't make them any less successful or any less or more happy than I am. And that's quite a hard lesson for me to learn, which I think I've learned over the years of doing this film.
In one respect, you seem to have beaten the mortality tables. I think if you asked an actuary, he would have said that odds are one of your subjects would have died by now, maybe even two. But none has. Should that occur? Are you are these your children? Are they your subjects? Are they strangers? Are they friends? What is your relationship?
Well, they're family. I mean, that's how I see it. Some of us are close, some of us aren't close, but we have this blood bond in a sense. And so I just hope that I'm the one that goes first. I should do, statistically, as you would say, but I can't even begin to think how one would handle it. I mean, if I knew, for example, one of them was terminally ill, you know, and didn't have long to live, what would I do? I mean, those are decisions I can only make when they're in front of me. They're kind of unimaginable to think about sitting here now.
Michael, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Michael Apted is the director of the Up series. The most recent installment, 49 Up, is being released in the United States October 6th. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Mark Phillips, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Rob Christensen was our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from Live from Lincoln Center, presenting Audra McDonald and Friends, featuring Patti LuPone and Nellie McKay on October 12th. Check local listings for times. On the Media is also supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.